You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Managing Neuromyelitis Optica Spectrum Disorders. How can you achieve long-term relapse-free outcomes in practice? I'm Dr. Lisa Koons, and I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Dean Wingerchuk, professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, and the host for this podcast, and Dr. Brian Wainshaker from the University of Virginia Health's Neurology Department. In this podcast, we will discuss advances in targeted treatment options for overcoming NMOSD. Welcome, Drs. Wingerchuk and Wainshaker.
Well, thank you very much. This is Dean Wingerchuk. It's a pleasure joining you today and having Brian, you join us as well. Let's begin with the first of a series of questions that have to do with managing NMOSD with aquaporin 4 IgG antibodies. Could you begin by explaining the role of attack prevention in optimizing the disease outcome for these patients?
Thanks, Dean. I think we all know, the major manifestations of neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder are acute attacks. The most common are optic neuritis and myelitis, but other attacks can affect the brain and the brainstem. Many of the manifestations of these attacks are quite distinct from those seen in multiple sclerosis, with which neuromyelitis optica is most often confused. Probably the most common attack affecting the brain or brainstem is intractable nausea, vomiting, and hiccups due to inflammation in the dorsal medulla. Disability in neuromyelitis optica, unlike MS, where this disability develops in a progressive way, usually occurs as a result of increments, as a result of sequelae of attacks. And therefore, by preventing attacks, it's quite likely that we can have a major impact on disability in neuromyelitis optica.
Indeed. Thank you, Brian. So fortunately, in the last 3 years or so, we've seen the approval of new therapies indicated for NMOSD with the aquaporin 4 antibody. Let's begin a series of questions that address treatment scenarios. The first would be, what factors do you consider, say, efficacy and safety related factors, if you're selecting an approved therapy for someone who's newly diagnosed with the disease?
As you've said, efficacy and safety are always the key considerations. So let's talk about efficacy first. And the first question that might naturally arise is, can we, in an individual, by analyzing aspects of their disease or biomarkers, predict which patients would respond to which drugs? As it turns out, at least in 2023, we do not have good biomarkers that would tell us that a given patient is likely to respond to one or other drug. The pathways that are being targeted, which are complement activation by eculizumab, B cells, and autoantibody production by inebilizumab, and the IL-6 inflammatory pathway by sotralizumab, really apply to all patients. So at this time, we really can't predict which patients will respond to which drug. Then the next question that arises is one of these agents clearly superior to other agents? And I think there is some controversy here, but probably a majority opinion, and certainly my opinion, is because of differences in design of the clinical trials, inclusion, exclusion criteria, how attacks were adjudicated. And because the efficacy is really very, very good for all of these agents, somewhere between 70 and 95% prevention of attacks, we really can't be sure that any one agent is superior to the other. So now let's turn to safety. And safety, fortunately, has been very, very good for all of these agents. There are different safety issues for eculizumab. There is concern about meningococcal sepsis, but fortunately, there's a very effective mitigation strategy with vaccination. There are concerns about infections with the other agents, but fortunately, now with extension studies that are approximately 4 years in duration, we've not seen major problems with infections. We've learned how to mitigate infection by vaccination, by testing in advance patients who are going to go on B-cell depleters for hepatitis serology, for TB status, but it really hasn't been a problem. So really, the issues come down to cost, and especially insurance considerations, and different modes of administration and convenience. These become major factors in choosing which patients will get which drug.
Yes, thank you. So it sounds as though in a, let's say, a newly diagnosed and treatment naive patient who was seropositive, you'd be comfortable if they were able to access any of the approved therapies for relapse prevention.
Yes, I'd say that's true.
Okay. Well, what about a patient then who had breakthrough disease on therapy? Would that change your thinking about how to select their next treatment? And perhaps even associated with that, what would convince you that a change was necessary, that the patient really had had breakthrough disease activity significant enough to warrant such a change?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And there are a lot of opinions, but I don't think we have a lot of data. None of the agents are 100% effective, and they're all fairly close. I would say most would say, especially since attacks are have considerable potential to produce disability, that we don't want to continue any given treatment after the patient has had a severe attack. So most people, I think, would feel that after a single severe attack, especially since we have other options, we should switch to another treatment. However, if the patient had been stable and had a mild to moderate attack, perhaps we'd feel comfortable continuing that treatment.
If a patient who is seropositive for aquaporin 4, very clearly has NMO, is using an off-label therapy and has new disease activity, how would you counsel that individual?
I would start by saying that patients who have been stable on non-approved treatment, it's a very difficult decision as to whether to switch that patient to an approved treatment. In general, we do like using approved treatments. We should be using approved treatments. And now we have fairly decent four-year extension study, which show that the long-term efficacy is fairly good. But many neurologists would say that if a patient were stable, if it ain't broke, don't try to fix it. So this is still a controversial area, but in general, if the patient had any substantial disease activity on a non-approved treatment, most would feel that they should be switched to one of the three FDA-approved drugs. And I don't really think we have too many guidelines as to which to choose. Some would feel that if the patient had been on a B-cell depleter and rituximab is the most widely used off-label treatment, we should search for a drug with a different mechanism of action. But there is enough difference between rituximab and inebilizumab in terms of the number of B cells or the range of B cells that are depleted, in particular plasmablasts and plasma cells that are more effectively depleted by inebilizumabs. There's differences in the mechanism of depletion whether complement-mediated or antibody-dependent cell-mediated depletion of B cells, that I don't think we should assume that patients failing rituximab could not be considered for inebilizumab. So I think really any of the three approved treatments are reasonable choices.
As you said a moment ago, we've got greater than four-year data accumulating in open label extension studies, which have been informative, especially for safety purposes. But what are some of the questions that you still have and would like to answer, if possible, regarding our currently approved therapies?
Well, of course, when I said we really don't have data at this point as to whether one drug is more effective than the other, lack of data doesn't mean that ultimately we may not have evidence in that way. And I think trying to conduct some type of head-to-head comparison would be ideal. With the very high level of efficacy in a fairly or relatively uncommon condition, of course, this is going to be a great challenge. We do have now four-year extension data that look very promising for all three of the FDA-approved drugs, but longer-term effectiveness will be quite important. And of course, there are selected patients, such as perhaps the patient with very active disease. That might be a special instance, and perhaps studying patients with that kind of issue, we may find that one treatment is better than the other. So I think there is more that can and should be done to try to enhance our ability to select the optimal treatment for a given patient.
I think if one stands back for a moment and surveys the field of neurology and compares how progress was made in multiple sclerosis and relapsing MS, for example, NMO really stands out as a tremendous therapeutic success in recent years. The effect size, the ability to reduce relapse risk has, with our current three approved therapies, is really quite excellent. But of course, we haven't cured the disease yet. What, in your opinion, are the most promising emerging therapies or therapeutic concepts that are being pursued or maybe you think should be pursued?
I absolutely agree about the initial success that we've had and the very high effect size of our current approved treatments. It's a blessing, but also going to make it very difficult to try to answer some of these questions as to which is more effective. There are other approaches to deplete B cells, and there are active clinical trials of agents that target B cell activating factor and its receptor, the TACI protein. Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors are of great interest for multiple sclerosis. They target both B cells, but also mononuclear cells. And those agents are also being studied in neuromyelitis optica. But I think more broadly, there is a lot of interest in whether we can exploit the fact that we know the target antigen for neuromyelitis optica to develop perhaps antigen specifics, perhaps less specific treatments that might be as effective, maybe more effective, by modulating the immune system strategy called immune tolerance, that in the end may enhance immune regulation, perhaps in an antigen specific way. And this is being studied in a variety of platforms that can accomplish this. For example, there has been a study of isolating dendritic cells that are tolerizing and manipulating them ex vivo with cocktails of cytokines, as well as antigen exposure, and reinfusing them into the patients. And at least it's being shown that this can enhance certain cytokines that are regulatory and other measures, I won't call them surrogate measures, but at least offer some proof of concept that this might be an effective strategy, because in the long run, we would like to not have to keep patients on profoundly immunosuppressive agents for long periods of time. So I think this whole concept of immune tolerance is an important one, especially since we know the target antigen, and we'll see how that develops.
Excellent. Thank you for that overview. Well, that's all the time we have today. Appreciate, Brian, your very informed and decades-long insights as you've contributed to, as well as observed the evolution of this field. So thank you for sharing that with us as we review the advances in our targeted treatment options to overcome this disease.
Okay, I want to thank you both for sharing your thoughts and insights and experience with us today. And thank you for the listeners for joining us. We hope you will listen to another episode in the series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And I want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Genentech, who provided an educational grant for this activity.